Thanks again to our listeners for tuning in today as we discuss the difficult task of setting limits and disciplining kids. Today, I am joined here by my friend and colleague at Wonders and Worries, Michelle Martin. Michelle, do you want to share a little bit about yourself?
I do. Thanks, Julie. First of all, I'm a mom of four. I'm a Mimi of one. Then I'm a wife. I've been married for about 25 years. And then in my hierarchy, I'm a child life specialist. And I've done that for 28 years. So this topic is near and dear to my heart because all of my children, I've been able to use these skills along with teaching parents how to utilize them as well. So I think our listeners will get a lot out of it.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle. We are so excited that you are here today as our guest expert. Now, before we dive right into this topic, Michelle and I wanted to take a moment to kind of touch on the relevance of why we felt like this topic needed to be discussed. Right now, we recognize that in this world, there's just so much that is stressful in our day-to-day. As an adult, sometimes the daily stressors, even with all of my training in self-care and in working through big feelings, I still struggle with feeling calm and having what we refer to in the clinical world as kind of that self-regulation. So we know that sometimes we find ourselves just needing to maybe go on a Netflix binge or have a good cry or some dark salted chocolate. For children, the dysregulation that they feel sometimes is reflected through their behaviors. So you might see sleep changes, increased irritability, trouble listening, maybe more tearfulness in the afternoons, or stubborn with ways they didn't used to have to be, which are kind of all their ways to signal that dysregulation. So with all the stress that we are carrying, it's very normal to assume that our children are carrying their own version of what that stress looks like too. Some of it being trickled down from maybe what they're feeling at home, but also with just kind of what they're feeling in the world, having to wear a mask, those changes in routines, not being able to just go ride your bike over to your friend's house. And so really what we're trying to do is add that complexity of just taking that layer off and allowing children to feel so much more comfortable, but also give the structure that they need. For our Wonders and Worries families, we also recognize the added complexity of stress that your new diagnosis has on your family. Even for many of our families that have been connected for years, we are still seeing an upsurge of kids that are coming back to their parents with questions and concerns specifically related to what happens if their parent were to catch coronavirus. So that's why we're here, helping to create some structure and some boundaries for children to help them better be able to process and cope to the world around them.
Absolutely. So I want to start with the definition of discipline. I think that word kind of has a negative connotation. But if you look at the word discipline and its Latin root, disciplina, if I'm saying that correctly, actually means instruction and training. So as parents, that's our job. We're to teach our children, introduce them to new life skills and help them to learn. So the base root of that too is to learn. Many times, like you were saying, they feel those emotions from not only their world, but if mom and dad are stressed, the kids are going to react to that as well. So helping guiding them through those big feelings, no matter what age they are, can be super helpful. Many of us grew up just being told, don't do that. And what we're going to do today, and I'll explain in a little bit, is that we're going to take that to a higher level. So it's not just a don't do that, mom said no. It's guiding our children to the next step of what is appropriate behavior. So we're going to talk about limit setting. We're going to talk about discipline. And they, I think they go hand in hand. So why do we need to set limits? Children thrive when there is security, when there are boundaries put in place with their behavior. If things are chaotic and out of control, it's unsettling for children. And many times parents with a new diagnosis or even a long-term diagnosis, they're overwhelmed with what's going on. And I try to remind them, don't stop parenting. It's important for your child to have that predictability, to have that structure, and to know mom is still mom, dad is still dad. They still have expectations from me. So Don't let behavior slide. It is not worth it. So when our children feel insecure with all these changes going on, mom and dad not acting like themselves, their anxiety will increase. And we don't want that for them. It's already a challenging time when their parents going through treatment. So we also want to protect them. So, you know, sometimes children make poor choices that can be harmful to them or harmful to the people around them. And even the things around them, they might be destructive, and we want to keep them from any one of those things. It always reminds me that children can benefit from this so much because they learn delayed gratification. Like, they can't get what they want immediately, but that's a life skill. We all have to learn that. They learn some self-control, and then they, as they understand what their limits are, some self-discipline too. So it's really useful. I've used it with all of my children, probably up to the edge of middle school. And then all of those
a long
rules
time
changed.
Ago,
so, when I was a child life specialist in the hospital, I was on the elevator with a few nurses, and it was after their shift, but I was just coming to work. And one of the men was going on and on about yelling at his son to stop doing something. And I didn't know these people, but I was bold enough to say, "But did you tell him what to do instead?" And they all just stared at me. But I think I made a really good point. Like, your child is just scared of you. But did you teach him what the right thing was to do and what you would have preferred him to do? So yeah, it's valuable in so many ways. So the process is an easy word to remember, ACT. A-C-T. So the first thing that you want to do is acknowledge the feeling. And you may or may not be right. If you're wrong, don't worry about it. Your child will correct you. but acknowledge the feeling. And then you want to communicate the limit. And then you want to target that alternative. All right. So for example, your sister is, oh, wait, no, let me back up. For example, you are so angry. Your sister is not for hitting. You can hit this pillow. Or you could use that same scenario. You are so angry. Your sister is not for hitting. Would you like to hit this pillow, or do you want to hit this bop bag? So giving a choice in there. But what's happened is you've acknowledged the feeling that you see in your child. Hopefully you're correct. If not, that's okay. Your child will correct you, and it can become a learning tool. But you've said what is not appropriate, but you've given an alternative, and there's teaching in that. The child has some control over the situation when choices are given, and that can build their self-esteem as well. So, you know what, this skill can be used even with the youngest children, and I'll give an example from my almost four-year-old grandson. So it was bedtime, and he wanted a drink of water. And he said, "I want 20 sips." And his dad said, "No, you can have 5 sips." But the four-year-old came back, "I want 10 sips." And his dad said, "No, we're going to 5 sips. You may have 5 sips." So children can be manipulative, right? We were both surprised to hear that story of him taking it that far. But even young children. So you kind of have to, like, stick to the plan that you've put in place. So you've given some limitations on what it is they can do. Your child might come right back with a third choice. And you say, "No, like my example earlier, you can hit the pillow or you can hit the bop bag." And they might argue with that a little bit. If it does get to that, I would just go, "Nope, I've given you choices. That's my final answer." And again, it kind of helps guide the child to make a good choice and to move forward. And arguing is not acceptable. So
a lot of these kids, I think, even with my own children who are ranging from high school to kindergarten, so I have a wide plethora of ages in my household. If you haven't been using this process, it's not too late to start.
Right.
It just means that you might have more resistance in the beginning. And I think with, like Michelle referenced, that consistency and that non-negotiation part of this is our limit that we are doing, and then letting that be what you follow through. I think that it will help. It does take consistency and time, but your children will get the process down.
Absolutely. Yeah. And consistency is huge. You can't go back and forth from an old discipline style and then to this one. It's going to be too confusing for the child and they'll never learn what it is we're really trying to teach them. And, you know, being consistent is predictable. And then when parents are predictable in their reaction to their children, it helps the children learn as well, like what's acceptable, what's not, or how my parent's going to react.
Absolutely. Consistency is so key. Also, in terms of parenting, it's important for us to be consistent in terms of our learning and the way that we are explaining things.
The biggest thing that differs, I think, from parenting of when us adults were children to now is we used to navigate on a very authoritarian, fear-based model. So in a lot of families, it was, don't do that because I said so. Or there's that fear of if you don't stop it, you're going to get a spanking. So that whole if then threatening kind of conversation can come across as something that is very fear-based for your child. So your children may stop doing the behavior, but they're not doing it out of self-regulation. They're doing it out of fear. And so that's what we want to stay away from. A big thing that I always tell any parent I'm supporting is, before you have a conversation with your child, even in the heat of a moment, kind of stop and take your own temperature. Let's stop and take an emotional temperature on where we are. Are we so frustrated too? Do we feel like we have to yell and scream and we're incapable of modeling those behaviors we want to see our children have? Because if so, then that is a good time to tag out.
Because perhaps there's someone else in your family that can redirect. And if you have to utilize someone else, it doesn't mean that you've failed. It just means that you are taking a break and giving yourself the self-care that you need in this moment to re-regulate.
There are times with my daughter, who is 9, she's our youngest, where it's about to be a fueled conversation and I don't want it to go to that level. So I will be very open with her and say, I can't have this conversation with you right now. I need to calm myself down. Let's take a break and we'll come back together in a little while. And it lets her know that we're human, we're parents, but we have feelings, right? But it also lets her know that we need to have a conversation when we're both calm. So, you know, many of us, if we're yelled at, we shut down. We don't hear anything. We just get angry. Even if the parent is well-intended and trying to guide in that moment, the child's not hearing anything because they're getting yelled at. And it's protective, right? Like we just kind of turn off our ears and, you know, our emotions go higher right along with the parent. And that's not what a parent really wants to have happen. They want their child to listen and follow directions. And in high-energy situations, especially being yelled at, it's not going to happen.
You're absolutely right. The first thing we have to do is be able to get back to a state of calm so that we're in a place to be able to hear what's being told to us.
First of all, change your body language. Get down at their level. If you can, sit on the ground, have a minute of quiet where they maybe will realize, wow, I am the only one making noise right now and you are not responding to it. Take that as an opportunity to really use that calm voice to give requests. And then it helps your child do what you're asking because you are not coming at them with screaming or yelling. Obviously, we never would want you to go to a place of trying to name call or criticize. You can say, I do not like the choices that we are making now. That is an okay statement. But then to say a child, oh, you're being a brat, or, you know, you are being so rude. There's a way to phrase it where it's less of a name calling and more of focusing on the behaviors.
Right. It helps like to allow the child to know that they're valued no matter what their feelings are. So sometimes if I have a child that's really dysregulated and I'm a little bit out of control and screaming and crying, I'll whisper. I'll sit with them, as you suggested, Julie, but also whisper. And it kind of catches their attention in a different way because it's so unexpected. Like, oh my goodness, I really can't hear. I need to calm myself down to hear what's being said. So sometimes that works with the younger children just to get their attention. Not to take away from the emotions that they're feeling, but to also be able to check in with the child and see, you know, where is this coming from? Or is it time for us to calm and move forward? But yeah, whispering works.
I love that. I think another important thing that Michelle kind of touched on before is never assume that your child understands what they're doing wrong. Because I think we sometimes forget that our children don't think the same way that adults do. Their problem solving, their correlation between this happened because I did this, it's not succinct. They don't have all of those pathways connected yet. So it's about really building that bridge. Perfect example is you know, you hear of a dad who maybe had said, or a mom, you know, don't step off the curb on the sidewalk. And you might have a 5 or 6 year old that then steps off the curb. And of course, they're near traffic. That's dangerous. We need to change that behavior. But then in follow-up conversation with the child, that child might reveal that they don't even know what a curb is. They've never heard that word. They only know it as the sidewalk. And so it's about trying to calm the situation, but then also find out where they are and what they understand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like you said, coming from their perspective, right? And language choice, like not berating a child in the moment. You know, you're a bad boy. Like, you know, that's a label and it's unnecessary. So I love how you said to, you know, acknowledge the behavior. You're not doing this, or you are doing this, but not the person. So not to take away from a child's self-esteem or the image of themselves, or to hear I'm a bad boy or I'm a bad girl. And then to take that as a label that they carry with them can be super harmful, I think, just to who they are.
So really trying to avoid those fear-based models, you know, really try to model that appropriate calming behavior. Try to make sure that you are using common language between the two of you, that you both understand the language being used, but then also kind of moving towards motivation. So there is so much research now that shows that positive incentives for good behavior can carry so much more weight than the fear of a consequence or the fear of more threatening language. Now, that doesn't mean that children don't have consequences. It is okay to follow through with an appropriate consequence if your child breaks one of the rules that you have established. It's about setting what that would be beforehand as much as you can, so that it's not just threatening, but also praising a lot of those good behaviors that you're seeing. Sometimes it feels so ridiculous when my child has been a total beast falling apart to then be like, wow, thank you so much for putting on your listening ears, when really they have just been screaming for maybe 5 minutes before, and I don't want to praise them. But sometimes getting them to get back online and re-regulate involves praising the behaviors that you want to see them doing. Exactly. So that's another great way to intentionally encourage your child, point out the things that they're doing well, that's helping them participate and move to a place of healing, and kind of then get to the motivation of moving past the behaviors.
Exactly. Yes. And something else to keep in mind is that, you know, parents, sometimes when we work with them, we'll list a whole bunch of behaviors that they don't like in their child that they want to change. It's impossible to do all of that at once. This is a great skill base, but I would look to the most high priority behavior. So if it's hitting, let's just focus on that. Let's just focus on giving the child the ability to control themselves and transfer that energy and feeling to something that's more acceptable. It's not to say you're going to let everything go, right? But if a child is involved in so many different behaviors the parent doesn't like, let's pick the most, that the highest priority, the one that impacts their world the most, and then be very consistent. And, you know, the motivation in poor behavior, like sometimes parents have to step back, and you alluded to this earlier. Sometimes they don't know how to talk about what it is that they're feeling. So it comes out in behavior. You know, are they hungry? Are they tired? Do they have a bad day at school? Are they reacting to the parent's stress in front of them? So, you know, trying to understand where the behavior is coming from can help the parent guide the child as well. So, you know, if they have great big feelings inside of them and they don't know how to label it, they don't know how to talk about it, they don't know how to let it out in a healthy way, it's probably going to come out in a way where a parent is not going to appreciate it. So that's where our job as parents is to step in and give them some guidance around it.
So what we're going to be doing is just taking a minute to touch on the different components of child development and sort of the different techniques that might work better for different age groups. Know that no child is a carbon copy of each other. So what works for maybe one of your children at that age may not work for the other. And as a mom of four, I see that firsthand every day. I have one child that is very headstrong and she knows what she wants and she's going to fight hard for it. And then I have another one who is much quieter, much more of a people pleaser and quicker to turn around a behavior with the right conversation or the right goal set in mind. So it's about knowing your children, but also just stopping for a minute and saying, okay, developmentally, what are my kids kind of most at right now? So I'm looking at that, kind of thinking of our toddler and preschooler. A lot of these kids are still just kind of learning that regulation for what their bodies can do and are capable of. So it's kind of like they're constantly in that battle for control. This is where you have the kids all the time saying, me do it by myself, or I do this, or no. They are wanting to be the boss of their bodies, and that is developmentally appropriate. But sometimes that comes with them trying to do things that maybe are not safe. Not wanting to wear a car seat, or be buckled in the car, or wanting to cross the street by themselves. Obviously, there are things then that we have to kind of take that control away, but just know that is something that is a huge struggle for them. A lot of times, these are the kids that are going to really feed off of the parent's energy. So if you have, as a parent, are feeling very stressed and unsupported, we just know that also some of that is going to trickle into what you are seeing with your children. You might notice dysregulated sleep patterns, or maybe they're extra clingy to you, or maybe they come across as very distant and frustrated. We've had some parents who are in the hospital for a length of time, either following an illness or some treatment, and their children are either overly clingy when they come back home, or kind of the opposite. They're a little bit irky. They are upset that, you know, the parent is kind of back in the equation. And when you have other people caring for your children, it's very likely they've done it differently. And so it's all about kind of getting it back on track a little bit.
And toddlers, preschoolers, they very much see everything going on around them. I think parents forget that they're watching us and we're their guides and we're modeling for them, hopefully, the behavior that we want to see in them. That's across all ages, but I think for the youngest ones, they like to play dress up and pretend to be mom and pretend to be dad. So they're really watching us.
Yes.
It's a great opportunity to model what we want for them.
As we move into our early elementary, so these are kids like kindergarten through second grade, third grade. These are your kids that are just such curious learners and really want to figure out the wonders and the ways of the world. These are your kids that have that budding independence that maybe they don't have the wherewithal to know, hey, now's not the right time to do this, or I do need help doing this. For example, kids that would go into the kitchen and open a carton of milk to be able to pour themselves milk or do some spontaneous baking, but not know the sequential steps that go with following directions. So they go into the kitchen and the jug's too heavy and they drop the jug and it spills all over the floor. And for many of our families, it might be on a day that you're recovering from chemotherapy or you aren't feeling so well or you're having a lot of joint pain and timing is just really terrible. And while there's nothing malicious behind their actions, they're not doing this to prove a point or to not listen to you. Really, all they can think at that moment is, what can I do to be able to fulfill my need? So in a lot of ways, they're kind of like tiny tornadoes, which can be really difficult. So when they start having big feelings, part of our job as parents, helping them is to figure out how to have a job in calming their body. How can they be a part of the process because that's really what they want to do. They want to be a part of things. And sometimes your conflict comes from them not feeling like they get to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes too, it's attention seeking behavior. So like you mentioned earlier, mom and dad might be gone. They might be at the hospital for any amount of time. And the mom and dad comes home and they're still not feeling well and they get a lot of attention and the children feel a little bit left out or displaced. I had a 5-year-old recently tell me that I'm used to being by myself. Before, mom and dad were working and I did things by myself. And now mom's really busy helping dad and I'm still doing things by myself. So they want attention and they know when the attention is given elsewhere. So sometimes as parents, we have to pause in the moment, especially when our, you know, we might be busy cooking dinner or washing dishes and very involved in whatever it is we have going on, and our children will come to us and we really need to pause and pay attention to what it is they need or want. And that's across all ages. It's not just these littles we're talking about, but across the ages to give them the attention that they do need. So, and bad or poor behavior, let's say that, not bad behavior, less agreeable behavior is still attention, right? So positive seeking attention, negative seeking attention, it's still attention.
The world right now where families have been quarantined at home together in many cases for 5 and 6 months, mom and dad maybe worked away from the home and the child was in school or in daycare. And now that maybe hasn't been the place for a chunk of time, I think you're going to see a rise in some of those attention-seeking behaviors as we have to start separating again. We are even seeing that some with my fourth grader who has always been this independent personality. But now if she sees me pick up a purse to look like I'm going out the door somewhere, it's, where are you going? When are you coming back? Why? What if you're not here at bedtime? And normally, it's if anything, I'm going to the grocery store or, you know, dropping something in the mailbox down the street. It's just that stress of kind of being together for so long. And I say it's stress. It's beautiful that we've had that opportunity, but it is stressful because it's changed that dynamic. Now there's that attachment that sometimes makes them a little bit less resistance to separation. And so I think we're seeing that a little bit as a stressor for kids. And sometimes you see some of that negative baby talking and other behaviors start coming out that maybe doesn't even fit their developmental milestones. So kind of looking at our teens and tweens. So these are our late elementary school, our early middle schoolers. These are the kids who really are in that stage where they're doing a lot of introspection. So I kind of feel like our younger elementary school kids are the kids that they are looking at the world with a microscope. They are exploring and wanting to know and do and see. For the middle schooler kids, it's when they kind of start looking at themselves with a microscope. And it's important. I think it's important in their development because they are learning how to grow and develop that inner moral code and compass and how to be engaged. But sometimes this is where you see your child that has always been so fun loving and so engaging, all of a sudden very insecure, maybe caring about what they look like or who they're with, or even mom and dad who are their best friend at home out in the world. You're not anymore. You are sometimes an embarrassment and, and they don't want you to say that a certain way. And they're going to kind of come at you from that way. And it's less a reflection of you and more a reflection of how they're really just so looking and breaking apart and taking deep dives into who they are and how the world's perceiving them.
Absolutely. You know, I think they're trying to learn some independence and grow and be individuals. And I find that's hard sometimes for parents to allow that process to happen. Some parents still want to control their children, but this is the age where they have to give a little bit of that up. And I don't know that all parents are comfortable with that. I think they're worried that their children will then choose the path that wouldn't be the best for them. That might be part of the control. for some parents who are close to their children and have good relationships, when they get to this stage, it's a little bit hard because, like you're saying, they, you know, they're good friends at home, but they don't want to be seen with their parents in public. And parents shouldn't take that personally. It does feel personal, but it's normal. It's what we want for our children. We want our children to grow and be individuals and, yes, make good choices, but to make the choices that fit who they're going to be as they age and grow.
Yeah. And then also with teenagers, kind of the younger adults, I guess, is what we would technically refer to them as. Behaviors here are much more, less looking at how I am on the inside and more about how do I fit into the world. So they start moving into that egocentric model of kind of like toddlers, where they start thinking about themselves more than anyone else. But it's not so much in a negative way. It's in a, I want to build up my whole friend system, or friends are their lifeline, belonging to apps and doing things that their friends are doing sometimes carries more weight than anything that they would be doing by themselves.
Absolutely. And you know, the other thing I think about, like just my own boys, and the oldest is 24. When they were in high school, I was trying to give them that independence and some still guidance, right? But the approach that I gave to them at that time was, if they came to me with something that was just off for them or they didn't know how to tackle it, I would say to them, what do you think the solution is? So across all ages, we want our children to be involved in this conversation, right? Engaged in the behavior. As they get older, we have to change that language a little bit. You know, when I ask my boys, like, what do you think we could do about this? Or, you know, how can you handle this situation that's comfortable to you? It was then a conversation. It wasn't me telling them what to do. Yeah, if they got off track, then, you know, something that I felt like was not going to come out in the way that they'd hoped to, you know, I would inquire about that. But, you know, giving them that control. You know, people are more likely to comply with discipline or rules, regulations, whatever it is, if they feel like they're accepted for the people that they are as individuals. So, you know, I feel like overall, like choices and alternatives we give to our children, regardless of the age, within their developmental stage, there are choices, even for the littlest ones. So, but it teaches them self-control and responsibility. You know, it also teaches them to tolerate frustration. Frustrations happen throughout a person's lifetime in so many ways, but teaching our children some self-control can help them therefore learn how to tolerate when things don't go their way. And nobody grows and learns when things are out of control and chaotic and disorganized. So allowing the structure in place to guide our children, regardless of their age, can help them grow.
Gosh, that growth is so important. And we recognize that. But also as mothers, as co-parents, as child life specialists, we recognize also that that growth is really messy at times. Not every day is perfect and beautiful, and you're not going to always walk away from conflict or from setting limits or from disciplining and feel like, oh, that was awesome. Because at the end of the day, disciplining your child is terrible. Mm-hmm. It feels good for nobody. It's important and it's necessary, but we recognize that it feels terrible, especially if you have a lot of loss right now, or you're grieving a big change in your family, or maybe you're struggling with a new diagnosis. We recognize that that does not come easy. And we know that sometimes it's still going to feel very messy. And that's okay, because with practice and with consistency and with going back and having those important conversations and really building your own network of support, so it's not just one parent that is on board, you have the other caregivers in the family really there to also be a part of the plan, I feel like you will in time start to see some more successful disciplining.
Absolutely. And yeah, it doesn't feel right sometimes to discipline our children, and it can be tiring. It can be exhausting to say the same thing over and over again, but it's worth it. It's well worth putting the energy into guiding our children and helping them become strong, independent people and behave in a way that we appreciate.
Thank you so much for tuning in to our episode today on parenting and disciplining your children. We hope, if anything, you walk away with the acknowledgement that parenting takes time and effort. It is not easy for anybody in any walk of life. We are hopeful that some of the tools we discussed here can be put into practice in your own family and will help bring more success and calm. Raising kind and responsible humans is not easy work, but please know that throughout all of this, together, we will. For more episodes and for future support, please feel free to check out our website, www.wondersandworries.org. Thank you for tuning in.